It is Thursday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the political situation in Zimbabwe remains uncertain following the military takeover.
It certainly seems to be that there are shifts within the ruling structures in the country.
President Donald Trump shifts his focus back to domestic issues following his Asia trip, and stand-in Santas get a refresher course for the holidays. It's all ahead. A day after Zimbabwe's military seized power, a media report quoting an intelligence source says President Robert Mugabe is insisting he's the country's only legitimate ruler and is resisting mediation to pave the way for his exit from power. The 93-year-old Mr. Mugabe, who has ruled the country for 37 years, is said to be under house arrest. Soon after taking control of state television, the military said it was targeting those around Mr. Mugabe to pacify what it called a degenerating political, social, and economic situation, which could result in violence. After Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sacked last week, Army Chief General Constantine Chiwenga threatened to end what he called a purge of ruling ZANU-PF party allies. Ryan Cummings is director of Signal Risk, an Africa-focused political and security consultancy. Speaking from Cape Town, he tells International Edition's Victor Beattie it's unclear that what is unfolding in Zimbabwe is a coup.
But I think in deeper considerations, and as the situation continues to unfold, there certainly seems to be that there are shifts within the ruling structures in the country, and that this debacle may well end with a change in government, and therefore could definitively be described as some form of a military takeover, or at least military action, which has resulted in a shift in dispensation.
Ryan, did the army's action surprise you, or did you see this coming?
Well, I think there was a lot of speculation. The minute the ZANU-PF administration of Robert Mugabe sought to move against a faction that was led by Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mnangagwa has always commanded quite significant respect and support from military structures within Zimbabwe, specifically from the Zimbabwean Defense Force itself, but also from the war veterans that fought in the country's so-called struggle for liberation. And the minute that the state had moved against this faction, and it was potentially done to assure that a separate faction of the ruling party led by Grace Mugabe, called the so-called Generation 40 faction of ZANU-PF, which was quite heavily represented by more youthful figures within the ruling structures and almost at the detriment to the so-called military factions of the state. The minute that this was done, there was perception that the military mobilized itself against the prevailing political structure in Zimbabwe amid concerns that their so-called interests, which is quite significant within the Zimbabwe political paradigm, may be threatened by this nascent administration that could potentially take over from President Mugabe if he was in any way incapacitated.
Most Zimbabweans have never known anyone in leadership besides Robert Mugabe. Is there hope among Zimbabweans, Zimbabwe economically at least, can start to turn a corner?
I think at this stage there's just a lot of uncertainty. I think that a lot of Zimbabweans, not that I would infer to speak on behalf of them, but I think there is a perception that many Zimbabweans felt that there was a need for change to take place, a change in government, a change in policy, just a change in approach to how the country was being governed.
Ryan Cummings said he believes there's a mix of uncertainty and optimism among Zimbabweans. While they don't want to shift to military rule, he says they're hopeful that this takeover could usher in reforms to end the country's long economic and political crisis. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we've been talking about over the past few weeks the sexual harassment and assault allegations that have been coming out about a number of high-profile individuals in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein case. Of course, the Hollywood mogul accused by dozens and dozens of women of sexual impropriety. propriety. And today we add another name to that list, Senator Al Franken of the U.S. state of Minnesota. He is facing allegations of sexual assault and harassment. A woman named Lee Ann Tweeden, who is a radio host in Los Angeles, tweeted that Franken groped her while she was sleeping during a trip the two took to entertain U.S. troops in the Middle East. Because, of course, Al Franken, before he was a senator, was a comedian. He appeared on the show Saturday Night Live, very well known for his comedy. She included, actually, a photo of this incident, which is now spreading around social media, that shows Tweeden sleeping on an Army plane. It was part of a U.S. Army tour to entertain the troops, while Franken is grabbing at her chest in the photo. There are now calls after that photo has gone out for Franken to be disciplined, and even calls for his resignation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell putting out a statement calling for an ethics investigation, saying that this behavior will not be tolerated. Franken putting out a statement saying that he does not remember this incident, and as to the photo, it was clearly intended to be funny, but wasn't. I shouldn't have done it, he says. This is, of course, the second sexual harassment allegation that have come out against a public official in the past few weeks. We've been talking about Roy Moore, who is running for the U.S. Senate seat in Alabama that's been vacated by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He's faced charges that he's dated teenagers while he was in his 30s, and a photo circulating in that case online shows a girl's yearbook that Moore reportedly signed when he was in his 30s, calling her beautiful. So those allegations continuing. And then in the entertainment world, they continue as well. We talked about Kevin Spacey, the actor who has had allegations levied against him that he groped and sexually harassed a number of young men. Well, now London's Old Vic Theatre, where Spacey was artistic director for a number of years, said that they had dozens of complaints from staffers and people there of Spacey's inappropriate behavior. So people reacting to that as well. Social media has really become, as we've said time and time again, a vehicle for people to speak out and a vehicle to really shed light on these instances. And I think that in these cases, we're seeing social media play a powerful role in shining light on these cases and sharing information and allowing people to come forward and talk about whether they've been abused recently or years ago, talk about these instances and finally bring them to light.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The Cambodian High Court dissolves the opposition party, cementing the one-party rule in that country. President Donald Trump responds to thanks from U.S. college athletes released from custody in China. A suicide blast hits an Afghan political gathering in Kabul, and U.N. agencies renew pleas to a Saudi coalition to lift a blockade on Yemen. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two new studies from the University of Southern California provide evidence that shows children can strengthen their brains by learning to read and play music. The studies suggest as little as 2 years of music instruction can provide wonderful benefits for children. The researchers found that musical training changes the makeup of the brain's white matter, which connects various parts of the brain to each other, as well as the gray matter, which processes information. The study also indicated that learning music can enhance parts of the brain that controls decision-making, provides abilities to focus attention, and restrain impulses. The findings come from an ongoing study that tracks and monitors brain development and behavioral changes in children between 6 and 7 years old who are learning to play and read music through a program with the Los Angeles Philharmonic's Youth Orchestra. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the French foreign minister visits Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to meet Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. President Donald Trump has shifted his focus back to domestic issues after returning from a 12-day trip to Asia. Trump is urging congressional Republicans to pass a tax reform measure to follow through on one of his key campaign promises. But the president and his Republican allies in Congress face a new political landscape in the wake of last week's election victories by Democrats in Virginia and New Jersey. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
President Trump is back in Washington after a lengthy trip to Asia that he says produced real benefits.
Very proud of it from a standpoint of security and safety, military, very proud, and trade. You will see numbers that you won't believe over the years.
Trump now shifts his focus to tax reform, a key test for the president and his Republican allies in Congress as they look to score a major legislative achievement before next year's congressional midterm election. House Speaker Paul Ryan.
We ran in 2016 on doing this tax reform. The president ran on doing this tax cut and tax reform. So this is about fulfilling our promises to the American people.
Trump was in Asia when Democrats won gubernatorial elections last week in New Jersey and Virginia. A possible danger sign for Republicans, says expert Kyle Condit.
The fact that the president is so polarizing and so unpopular, with approval ratings generally under about 40%, that, you know, Democrats are going to be extra motivated to come out.
A strong Democratic turnout could help them retake control of the House of Representatives next year for the first time since 2006, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
You can sort of smell when a wave is beginning. No guarantee it continues, but it's likely to. And that smell that was in the air in 2005 is in the air now.
Trump's approval ratings remain historically low for a first-year president, a warning sign for Republicans, says John Fortier.
And so if the president is where he is today, I think that is going to be very difficult for the party to even hold the House of Representatives in the next election.
But Democrats simply opposing Trump may not be enough for success.
Good morning,
says Jim Kessler.
Democrats have to make sure that they're not just the anti-Trump party, though, when they're running. They have to show they've got some sort of agenda to take full advantage.
The election results have also given Democrats hope of defeating Trump should he run for re-election in 2020. But Condit says that judgment is premature.
I wouldn't make any assumptions that the president was, you know, a dead duck or something heading into 2020 because, you know, his numbers were not very good in 2016, but he still figured out a way to thread the needle to win.
Trump and Republicans are now making an even more urgent push for tax reform, well aware that Republican fortunes in next year's midterm elections may hang in the balance. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel Jaber has again resisted Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri as not being detained against his will in Saudi Arabia, while accusing Iran and its Hezbollah proxy militia of trying to dominate Lebanon and meddling in Yemen and Bahrain. Visiting French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told reporters that he would meet the Lebanese Prime Minister and that Hariri was invited to travel to Paris. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The odd saga of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri's unusually long visit to Saudi Arabia, coupled with his unexpected resignation last week, took another unusual turn after France made it clear Hariri is invited to Paris. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian paid a courtesy call to the Saudi capital Riyadh, where he held a news conference with his Saudi counterpart Adel Jubeir.
Monsieur Hariri, que je verrai tout à l'heure, est invité en France.
Le Drian says Hariri, whom he is expected to meet, has been invited to France with his family by President Macron, and he can travel to France as soon as he would like and be welcomed as a friend. French President Emmanuel Macron, who was in Riyadh several days ago, repeated the offer while speaking earlier with French media.
Je me suis entretenu avec le prince héritier Mohammed bin Salman.
Macron says he met both Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Saad Hariri, adding there was agreement that Hariri would be invited to Paris as a French gesture of goodwill to bring calm and stability to Lebanon. Jaber told journalists Hariri is free to leave the kingdom at his leisure, despite claims by some Lebanese political leaders he is being held involuntarily. He says that Hariri is both a Saudi and a Lebanese national, and he and his family live in Saudi Arabia voluntarily and are free to travel to Lebanon whenever he so chooses, depending on his personal evaluation of his safety in Lebanon. He maintains there is no basis in fact to accusations Saudi Arabia is holding him hostage, not to mention the fact he is an ally of Riyadh. Some Arab analysts have said Hariri is in financial trouble due to the collapse of his Saudi construction company Ogier earlier this year. American University of Beirut political science professor Hilal Kashan tells VOA he believes Hariri's political career is over at the very least. In fact, by going to Paris, this means that he is going into exile, Kashan argues, even though the French are saying otherwise. Kashan also worries about further instability in Lebanon with a potential Hariri exile. This means that the cabinet's resignation is final and they have to find another prime minister, and I do not think they will be able to find one, so Lebanon is going to witness political backlash. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. As the Christmas season approaches, it seems there are Santa Clauses everywhere. But it takes more than a red suit and a white beard to be a Santa. The longest continuously running Santa Claus school in the world is celebrating its 80th anniversary this year. Erica Celeste takes us to Midland, Michigan to visit with this year's class.
It may only be November, but more than 250 Santas at the C.W. Howard Santa School are already decking the halls for Christmas. Charlie W. Howard, the featured Santa Claus in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade for 17 years and a consultant on the classic Christmas movie Miracle on 34th Street, started the school in 1937, says Tom Valent, the school's dean.
At that time, there was a great need for good Santa, better Santas. Santas didn't portray that image that we want. Santa Claus stands for all good things. And some of the gentlemen that were portraying that image weren't up to par then.
Today's Santas really do not have that problem. They attend the three-day workshop for a variety of other reasons, such as learning Santa sign language, facts about reindeer, and how to do proper dress and makeup. They also become familiar with the newest wish list toys, gain interview experience for radio and TV, and get tips for managing their business taxes. Robert Davis, who's played Santa for 30 years, has attended the school several times.
I think no matter how good you are at whatever you choose to do, you can always be better. And it not only does the school teach you so much, but when you interact with 250 fellow people that love the same thing you do, you learn something new every year.
The Santa's headquarters is the Santa House, which sits near the center of town in Midland, Michigan. Tom Valent designed the gingerbread-style house, which features a traditional cuckoo clock with animated dancers, in 1986. He also hand-carves the hundreds of displays inside, from animated elves painting toys and playing a piano, to a candy conveyor line, and a giant Santa chair. No one knows exactly how many Santas have graduated from the school, but conservative estimates place the number at 15,000. During that time, there have been students from North America, Europe, Africa, and Australia. This year, the school not only has Santas from all 50 states, but also 20 from Canada, 3 from Denmark, 1 from New Zealand, and 1 from Norway. That would be Fred Oster, also known as Oslo Santa. It's his 8th time at the school.
I have been Santa this Christmas 65 years. I started to be a Santa when I was 12.
The Santas never claim to be the one and only real Santa, but rather the spirit of Christmas. At the school's opening night Santa walk, they tell visiting children they're cousins of Santa. They also never promise anything, instead saying they'll try their best.
Anywhere I go, I try to make my contact and exchange with that child the very best that it can be, because that could be that child's best 5 minutes of the year.
After all, as founder Charles W. Howard was fond of saying, he errs who thinks Santa enters through the chimney. Santa enters through the heart. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Midland, Michigan.
Art to being Santa. Well, a 500-year-old masterpiece by Leonardo da Vinci that once sold for a mere $60 has broken the world's record for an art auction. Salvator Mundi, which depicts Christ raising his hand in a blessing, sold for $450 million at Christie's auction house in New York. The unidentified buyer made his bid by telephone. The seller is a Russian billionaire. Until Wednesday, the highest price paid for a painting at an auction was $179 million for Pablo Picasso's The Women of Algiers in 2015. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The West Bank is littered with landmines and unexploded ordnance due to decades of conflict beginning as far back as 1948. A survey conducted in 2012 identified 90 minefields. Of these, 13 were laid by the Jordanian military between 1948 and 1967. The remaining 77 minefields were laid by the Israeli military following the 1967 war. And landmines are not the only problem. Over half a century of armed conflict has left swaths of land contaminated with unexploded ordnance. After so many years, much of this war material lies buried beneath the soil, deep enough that it cannot be found with metal detectors. It is nonetheless highly dangerous to anyone digging in the soil, be it a farmer plowing a field or digging a new wall, or children to play. Indeed, children are the most frequent victims of landmines and unexploded ordnance. Too often, they do not recognize the danger of these objects and may pick up or even play with explosives. Clearing these hazards has been a difficult task, and not just due to the nature of such indiscriminate killers. Some of the contaminated areas are under Palestinian control, others are under Israeli control, while a number of zones are under Palestinian Authority civil control and joint Israeli-Palestinian Authority security control. Getting permission to demine was a long and arduous process. Following years of negotiations, the first humanitarian mine action program in the West Bank finally began in April 2014. The only mine clearance operated in the West Bank is the Halo Trust, a non-political, non-religious British charity, as well as a U.S. non-profit organization that specializes in the removal of explosive remnants of war. The group has already disposed of thousands of landmines and unexploded ordnance in the West Bank and hopes to clear by 2018 at least 9 minefields that lie dangerously close to Palestinian communities. Over the past 5 years, the United States has provided over $4.1 million for humanitarian mine action activities in the West Bank. Led by the U.S. Department of State and in partnership with the governments of the Netherlands and the United Kingdom, the United States is proud to support the Halo Trust's humanitarian mine action program in the West Bank.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.